It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to the show, everybody. It is a blisteringly hot day here in Washington, D.C. and across much of America. We're going to be talking about several hot topics today. We're going to kick off with half an hour on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and then a health care update, followed by a discussion of campaign 2012 and the debt ceiling negotiations. But joining us for our opening 30 minutes to talk a little bit about the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, which celebrates its opening day today, we have Richard Andriano, John Socknet, and Mike Waldron, all colleagues of mine from Patton Boggs and all experts in the mortgage and banking industry, here to talk to us a little bit about how this new agency is going to relate to the mortgage world. These guys are the authors of a brand new book. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But Rich, John, Mike, welcome to the show. And why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about how this bureau impacts the mortgage industry going forward.
Great. This is Rich, Kevin, and be glad to do that. Well, we do have a birth announcement today at midnight. Born was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and its length is as far as the eye can see, and weight is 800 pounds. It is a force to reckon with for the mortgage industry as well as any consumer financial product or service provider. For the mortgage industry, what's important is all of the various federal laws that have been spread among different agencies are now consolidated in the Bureau. So there's really one main authority for that. Plus, all of the changes that Dodd-Frank is requiring, all of those rules that it's requiring be written for the mortgage industry are now in the Bureau's lap. And these are very important. And to give a little context, I'll just mention two that are right off the bat the Bureau has to turn to. One is Congress was very concerned that with the mortgage crisis, a lot of consumers got loans who really couldn't afford those loans. So it added a requirement in the law to say, the lender, mortgage lender, when you make a loan, you must make a reasonable determination that that consumer can repay the loan. Now, a little earlier this year, the Fed Reserve proposed rules and made the comment deadline July 22nd, effectively saying, we're proposing it, but it's now we're going to punt it over to the Bureau, and the Bureau is going to have to finalize these rules. So right off the bat, the Bureau has to take this very significant proposal and turn it into a final rule, which will pretty much define, in large part, what type of credit is available and the cost of that credit going forward. The concern of the industry is if the standards are too strict or the rules for what is appropriate are too fuzzy, what the impact will be is lenders will, you know, withdraw, only make very conservative loans and only to very highly qualified borrowers, leaving a lot of people out of the home ownership business. Very important, and encourage everyone to pay attention to that effort. The second effort, the Bureau actually started a few months ago before it even officially opened its doors because it knew the project was so significant it would take a lot of time. Congress mandated that the Bureau, by a year from today, propose forms that will integrate the federal disclosures when you apply for a mortgage loan and when you close on that mortgage loan. Today, they're governed primarily by two different statutes. The disclosures don't work well. They don't talk to one another. Everybody dislikes them, consumers, the industry. And Congress heard that, and it's directed the Bureau, try to put these forms together, try to make them make sense. The Bureau already has gone through two rounds of seeking public comment, intends to go through three more rounds before the end of September. And I encourage folks in general to pay attention to this, and all you have to do is go to their website. You could see the current version of the forms, and we expect the new version to be proposed quite soon. So that gives you, those are two major things right off the bat, and gives you a little idea of the extensive power of this agency.
Gotcha. Well, let me turn to you, John, and ask. Rich talked a little bit about what's going on in this area, but I guess if I was a state regulator in my home state of Virginia or somewhere else across the country, I'd be wondering a lot about the interplay between what I do and have done to regulate this industry in the past, and now this new 800-pound gorilla has been birthed in Washington, D.C. Talk to me about how state regulators will interplay with this new agency.
A very good question. So a couple of things. As you said, the states have always been very active in the financial services industry, in particular the mortgage banking industry. Unfortunately, like many of the Fed regulators, they've been taken to task over their role or their lack of oversight in the financial meltdown. And so we have seen over the course of the last 18 months or so the states ramping back up, enacting new laws, taking greater interest in the industry, examining institutions more closely. So they absolutely are going to continue to be active and frankly be more active as they need to be a little bit reactive to what has gone on in the industry in the past. Second, what's important for the states, and they were active in doing this, the CFPB and a number of states, as well as a number of the state regulatory trade associations, have entered into what's called an information-sharing memorandum of understanding. And the goal there is for the CFPB and the states to continue to work closely together, share information about trends, share information about bad actors. And so, you know, we very much are going to continue to see the states playing a very active role. And it's telling that the states, you know, frankly, partially for their own self-preservation, have determined and decided that, okay, there's this new big monster, but we're going to make sure that we continue to play a role. Finally, you know, the CFPB, as Rich said, is going to be responsible for so many different laws. They simply do not have the staff to police and enforce nationwide, and they're going to leverage state resources to help do that.
I see. Well, let me, Michael, bring you into the mix here. That state resources is a good transition to talk about state attorney generals. They've been active, again, as part of the regulatory regime in the past with the mortgage industry. I know there's a lot of conversation. I hear the terms global settlement bandied about. Tell us a little bit about what state AGs are doing and what they might do going forward with the new bureau.
Yes, absolutely, and thanks, Kevin. It's really picking up off of the consistent theme that we're seeing here that both Rich and John have laid out, and it's the theme of coordination. The state AGs have been very active in the industry. Legislation, however, is not the tool of choice in their toolbox. Through the last 12 months or so, there have been extensive and coordinated efforts among the AGs to revamp the mortgage industry through investigations and enforcement actions. This theme of coordination will continue, and it will be, quite frankly, magnified through the CFPB. In April of this year, a statement of principles was executed by the National Association of Attorney Generals with the CFPB. It's one of many enforcement partnerships that CFPB has put in place. Most recently, they put one in place with the Judge Advocate Generals of the United States Armed Forces. They all have a common theme of coordination. In that April 2011 statement of principle, the parties agreed to several things, most importantly, to develop joint training programs and share information, to engage in regular consultation regarding mutual enforcement priorities, to develop a framework to share investigatory information, and to share and refer consumer complaints between AGs and the CFPB. I think it's very telling that former Ohio Attorney General is Obama's nominee for CFPB director. The state AGs will play a critical role in the CFPB going forward. And in fact, Cordray, in addressing the National Association of Attorney Generals in March of this year, came out and said directly that the state's attorney general will be an important partner for the Bureau because they understand as well as anyone the kinds of problems that consumers, their constituents, face. So this is very near and dear to his heart and to the Bureau's mission.
Well, let me come back to you, Rich, and ask, so the agency officially started today. What is the latest with them?
Yeah, very interesting. As Michael noted, we now have a nominee for director because the agency is supposed to be headed by a director. But until July 18th, we didn't even have a nominee. We now have one, but will there ever actually be a director is a big question. The Republicans in the Senate have said they will oppose any nominee until, in fact, there are changes made regarding the Bureau. Two of the ones they particularly want is to replace the director with a board or commission similar to Federal Trade Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, on the thought that that is a much more way to have a balanced bipartisan effort rather than have one person with what is really a tremendous amount of power and the ability through enforcement to literally put people out of business, that a commission or board would be better suited. The second is to take the Bureau from what is now an off-budget agency funded through the Federal Reserve and make it an on-budget agency that is more responsive to Congress. Again, given the significant power the Bureau has, the thought is Congress needs to be able to exercise more oversight over it. So I think we have a nominee. Whether we ever get a director will be an interesting thing because there may be changes in the Bureau structure before we move forward.
Yeah, I think getting director is a long road. We're going to take a break here. We're going to come back and talk with these guys more about their book and how that relates to this new agency and its mission. But you're listening to Capital Thinking. We'll be back with just a lot more right after this station break.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We are talking with three of my partners from Patton Boggs, Richard Andriano, John Socknet, Mike Waldron, about the newly formed, newly birthed Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which launched today, just 1 year after the passage of Dodd-Frank. We're also going to talk in a few minutes about their new book, The Mortgage Finance Regulation Answer Book, which they've published in conjunction with the Practicing Law Institute. But before we do that, Rich, let's go back, pick up our conversation about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and talk a little bit more about the campaign and efforts to change the Bureau and its powers.
Indeed, what had happened is while we also had the Senate saying Republicans saying they would not vote for any nominee until there are reforms, the House is actually moving forward with trying to adopt reforms. There were a series of separate bills introduced. One would change the director to a board or commission, as I mentioned, and the other would take the Bureau from an off-budget to an on-budget agency. There were a couple also different proposals. They have all made it through the House Financial Services Committee, have been consolidated into a single piece of legislation, and are certainly being, of course, backed by the chairman of that committee, Spencer Baucus. So we do have a very key member of the House sponsoring this legislation now. And Senate has been, while there is right now not a companion legislation that I know of, sounding similar themes. So the thought is there's a lot of voices on Capitol Hill to make a change. Certainly the nominee, we know with the debt ceiling talks, won't be addressed until after the summer recess is over and we're in the fall. And obviously that will leave more time for folks to try to work forward some of these changes. So the real interesting thing, though, it now creates is we have a Bureau, and there's nobody at the helm of the Bureau at the moment.
Right, and the nuances of the law means there's some things they can't do without a director.
Certainly. What Congress did, interestingly, in authorizing the Bureau is in some cases it gave the power to the Bureau, in some cases it gave the power to the director, thus creating a void when there's no director. And many have, in fact, raised questions, can the Bureau act at all or certainly adopt rules without a director? And I think those calls and those notes will become louder the longer we go without this being resolved.
Gotcha. Well, let's transition a little bit, talk about this exciting new book. It's called Mortgage Finance Regulation Answer Book, and it's published in conjunction with the Practicing Law Institute. Tell me a little bit about what led you to do this book and how it differs from maybe what else is out there talking about regulation of mortgage loans.
Sure. Glad to do that. What intrigued me when we were approached with the concept of creating the book is most of the publications out there on mortgage laws are just that they're legal publications, so they're written for lawyers in a very stilted manner and often restate the law but without giving practical guidance. And the concept here was to create something very different, something that, in fact, would be good for business persons, lawyers, and non-lawyer compliance personnel as well, to essentially give them the law and the basics of all the various laws governing the lending, mortgage lending, in a concise way. And the way the book does that and where it differs is it first just gives a very concise summary of the Dodd-Frank Act to give an idea of where things are headed. But then as to all the existing laws and fields, it presents those laws in a question and answer format, so the information is readily accessible by both lawyers and non-lawyers alike. And we think because of that, it makes it very unique. Is if you're looking for a particular issue, a particular question, you could hone in on that very quickly and get your answer done, not in a lawyerly way, but a very straightforward way.
Interesting. Well, tell me a little bit more about the topics covered in the book.
Of course, as I mentioned, it does start out with Dodd-Frank, but then we thought we would cover two general topics in addition. One was just because mortgage repurchase demands and mortgage insurance claims have become such a major issue in the industry. We thought it was helpful to address that, to educate the reader on a lot of the claims that are out there and that could be made so they could better understand the issues. So if particularly they're facing a repurchase claim or a denial of insurance, they know questions they might want to ask or avenues they may want to pursue to better have their concerns addressed. Also, we understood that while we as lawyers understand a lot of differences, such as in the security instrument, what's the difference between a deed of trust or a mortgage? A lot of people don't. So we have a basic just kind of a mortgage lending 101, if you will, that just goes through a lot of the basics of what's a deed of trust, a mortgage, what is a lien, what are super liens, and items like that. We then, of course, move on to the core laws, the Truth in Lending Act, Real Estate Procedures Act, and all of the main laws, but then also decided that it wouldn't be complete without addressing a lot of laws that are broader in application but important, such as privacy laws, bankruptcy, restrictions on telemarketing and use of emails for solicitation, obviously, you know, very key methods of solicitation but subject to significant restrictions. So all of those types of topics are covered. So it really gives you, in a nutshell, for someone who's new to the industry or been in the industry a while, a good summary of all the various laws affecting the industry.
Well, John and Mike, let me turn back to you. Talk to me a little bit about the various sectors of mortgage industry participants and maybe what each of those sectors can take out of this book.
Sure. It's Michael, and I'll start and then move on to John. Out of the crisis of the past several years in the industry, there's been a consistent criticism of the industry, and that is there's never been a culture of compliance. That industry members themselves were not vested in doing it right. And as Rich pointed out, we really sought to provide practical guidance that could be utilized as a tool by what we call and the industry calls the floor level folks, from the loan officers to the underwriters to the processors, to put together something in a format that's digestible so that they don't look at compliance as a rabbit being pulled out of a hat, but can look at it and be able to understand it, appreciate it, and become vested in an industry that is essentially resetting itself, and hopefully the participants themselves want to grow with it and change with it as it grows.
Very good. Yeah, and as a follow-on, we also think this is a great tool for the executives, the general counsels, the assistant general counsels who are responsible for either directly compliance or overseeing compliance departments. And it gives them a tool. Oftentimes when you're talking to business people, you've got to give a justification. Well, why? Well, there are so many laws, so many rules. This book would allow somebody who may have subject matter expertise, say, in truth in lending, but not know much about RESPA, for example, to be able to quickly find, without digging through the statute or regulation, an answer that can then easily translate it and pass along to the business folks as a justification. Why? Well, because Section 1203 says it's illegal. We strove really hard to find and create answers that were detailed enough to get to a lot of the basic answers, the core answers, with also the sources there to dig deeper if it was necessary.
Nice. Well, it does seem like one of the byproducts of the Bureau is, of course, more regulation, more need to train and educate people about that. Put your, look at your crystal ball, put your predictor's hat on here, and you guys tell me in the couple minutes we have left what you see as some of the agency's most likely actions in the next 6 months and what congressional and marketplace reactions might be.
I'm glad to do it. This is Rich. Initially, they do have to, particularly as I mentioned, adopt the repayment ability rules, and that will be significant because there are sister rules that have to be adopted by other agencies on risk retention. Those two together will pretty much define who can get a loan and who can't for the years going forward. And there is some recognition now appearing up on Capitol Hill that perhaps some of the provisions went too far, and maybe they do need to be revisited, and these regulations not too strict, so that, in fact, we don't make the crisis worse by making it impossible for people to buy homes or refinance their loans. So this will be cruel. It's rather crucial. It's a very significant economic issue, really goes to the heart of the crisis. And are these regulations going to move us out of the housing crisis or keep us in the housing crisis? So it's a very major issue. I know people sometimes, oh, it's mortgage things, it's technical. This is key to the economy. And so it's important that everyone really stay tuned and let their views known to both the Hill and to the regulators. The other thing we're going to see is a ramp up in this bureau. It is around 500 or so people now, probably be in the mid-500s by August 1st, where a lot of the personnel, you know, finally transition to the bureau. But it's not stopping there. This will be well north of 1,000 people at some point, and eventually could become a bureau that not only sets policy, but also has people out in various field offices examining both banks and non-banks. That whether it should become that size agency is actually now a matter of debate up on the Hill. That, you know, should it only set policy, or should it both set policy and be the enforcer of that policy down at the community level? That is going to be an interesting issue, I think, that we're all going to have to focus on moving forward.
Yeah, you mentioned that I think people who are non-depository institutions are very concerned with that outreach to them, figuring, hey, we're not the people that contributed to the economic downfall that brought on Dodd-Frank. Why are you dropping all this new regulation on us? I think that's going to be one of the more fascinating fights over this bureau in the months ahead. Well, listen, you guys, thanks for joining us. This is a terrific new book. Encourage folks who are interested, go out and get themselves a copy from the Practicing Law Institute of Mortgage Finance Regulation Answer Book 2011-2012, a great tool for outlining current federal requirements and highlights of how they interrelate with the new agency. We're going to be back to talk about healthcare reform here on Capital Thinking right after this commercial break.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, every once in a while, we like to bring on our healthcare policy gurus from our companion site, CapitalThinkingHealthcare.com. Great place to catch up on what's going on in the latest and greatest in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, all the regulations that are now taking place at various agencies. Joining us today, two of the folks from that website, Julie Black and Heidi Beinrue. Heidi, did I get your name right there?
You did.
All right, very good. I'm in the ballpark. Give us the latest and greatest. Julie, let's start with you. I know HHS has been a very busy department indeed this summer. Lots of draft regulations rolling out some of the cornerstone proposals in the Affordable Care Act, things involving accountable care organizations and state health insurance exchanges. Walk us through, Heidi, why don't you walk us through that and how that's being received in the marketplace?
Sure. Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me on. Well, as you know, the department released the draft regulations for the exchanges for several features just last week. So as you know, the healthcare reform law authorized health insurance exchanges to create competitive marketplaces for individuals and small businesses that didn't have options before to now shop and be able to obtain insurance. The new exchange market will allow individuals and employers to compare the price, the quality, and scope of different insurance plans, which is wonderful news for those that don't have insurance. Since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act last year, many states have already been taking steps to develop this framework to establish a state-based health insurance exchange. So if a state cannot or elects not to run a state-based exchange, the federal government will step in and run it for them, which is an interesting dynamic. So today, about 13 states have enacted legislation to create some sort of new exchange, and six have created these workarounds to establish the exchanges. Basically, the federal government has been giving states a lot of flexibility in how to create them. Most notably, though, the proposed rule allows for conditional approval of a state's framework if not yet entirely ready to be certified. The draft regulations provide a great deal of flexibility to states in terms of how states certify health plans to participate in these exchanges. But really, to answer your question, Kevin, the draft regulation is getting a much warmer reception than the ACO regulation that we saw earlier this summer. Although stakeholders continue to wait for regs that will define the essential health benefits, which is the package of services that health plans will be required to offer to individuals if they wish to participate in the exchange. So this is a really important part that we're still waiting for.
I see. Very interesting. Well, Julie, let me turn to you. I know one of the other big things to sort of roll out in the future is having the Health and Human Services Department define essential health benefits because that means a lot to health plans and providers and ultimately to the consumers who will be the end users of those plans. Talk to me about the status of that regulation.
Sure, and while these discussions haven't been able to hold a candle to the deficit reduction debate, it actually has been a hot topic, particularly this week, because the Institute of Medicine released its recommendations for coverage of preventive health care services for women, and they recommended eight services that should be covered without cost sharing. Some are controversial. Some include screening for gestational diabetes, HPV testing, counseling on STDs, counseling and screening for HIV, contraceptive methods, items to promote breastfeeding, screening and counseling to detect domestic violence, and yearly well women preventive visits. The HHS secretary has applauded these recommendations, and she will be making a decision during the first part of August regarding which preventive services should be covered without cost sharing. This was a separate provision of the Affordable Care Act from the essential benefits. However, consumers and stakeholders have latched on to the IOM's recommendations in the hopes that these preventive services will be included in the definition of an essential benefits package. In terms of the timeline, we expect the IOM to make a recommendation to the Secretary as to how she should define these benefits in a report that they will release this fall.
All right. Well, Julie, let me stick with you. I know that one of the draft regulations that's come out is basically establishing the co-op program. That's a consumer-operated and oriented plan program. Tell me about that program and how it interrelates with state health insurance exchanges.
Sure. This was an interesting provision in the Affordable Care Act, and it was really introduced by a senator as an alternative to a publicly run health plan. So a co-op program will allow for the creation of nonprofit health insurance insurers and enable them to offer competitive health plans both in the individual and small group markets. The department earlier this week previewed an announcement for funding in the amount of $3.8 billion in loans to fund both the initial co-op administrative costs and also to fund reserves in the case that, or in the event which we expect the co-op to need to pay out for insurance coverage. Some are expecting hospitals to be in the best position to participate in the program as an insurer. There's not been an official announcement of funding, but we do expect the first round of applications to be due in the late fall, with the awards to be announced this winter. The agency wants to ensure that the funds are out there to enable the co-ops to actually participate and offer insurance within the exchanges.
Gotcha. Heidi, I know we're on the brink of August here. It certainly feels like we're on the brink of August in Washington with all the heat. That's typically been a very quiet time. Congress goes home. The president jets off to Martha's Vineyard for vacation. A lot of the agencies sort of get sleepy during August. But it seems to me like this might be a summer when Health and Human Services isn't on vacation because they have so many things on their plate.
Yes, that is very true. I mean, we've seen many regulations come out already, and we're expecting a few more even before the fall. So some key regulatory issues for consideration in the coming months, they include things like methodologies for calculation of the enhanced FMAP rate, as authorized by the Affordable Care Act for newly eligible individuals. We're waiting for guidance to states regarding the establishment of Medicaid recovery audit contractors, which is key for physicians who treat Medicaid beneficiaries. We're waiting for Medicaid disproportionate share hospital payment information. In addition, Dr. Richard Gilfillan, who's the acting director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, he recently noted that the bundled payment rules for acute and post-acute care providers will be issued sooner than expected, which makes us all nervous. And other regulations that may be of interest to listeners is the covered outpatient drug rule. This rule will redefine the definition of average manufacturer's price for drugs used in numerous settings. The Physician Payment Sunshine Regulations, which provides more transparent reporting for physicians, and the Competitive Bidding Rule for Durable Medical Equipment. And we've already seen the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule Rules, the Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System, as well as the End-Stage Renal Disease Prospective Payment System proposed rules. So yes, not only is HHS not taking a vacation, but it looks like neither am I. This summer.
Well, I'll send you a postcard from the beach, honey.
Thank you.
Julie, let me come back to you because it seems like the department's trying to do an awful lot to get the Affordable Care Act implemented in its initial stages here. At the same time that up on the Hill, they're working on the parameters of what could be a grand bargain on the debt ceiling and other things, which if you're going to do anything, you're going to have to trim entitlements in the long term in order to make some of these numbers work out. So tell me a little bit about how the deficit reduction plans are going to impact healthcare programs in general and maybe some of the Affordable Care Act programs in particular.
Sure. We are looking at the clock ticking as we approach this August 2nd deadline to increase the debt ceiling. And what I think most people figure now is that there's likely to be an agreement to increase the debt ceiling, but to continue working on reducing the deficit through the end of the year. either through committee work or plans that the administration would propose. But nonetheless, there have been a number of proposals that really have been released by members in the administration, which do include plans related to health care. Some of those are actually commonly agreed upon, one of those being to repeal the long-term care program established in the Affordable Care Act, known as the CLASS program. Aside from the Affordable Care Act, some other provisions that most agree they'd like to see included in a deficit reduction proposal include reforming graduate medical education payments, accelerating payment changes to nursing homes and home health agencies, accelerating payment changes, it's code for cutting in this case, and then also reducing Medicare bad debt payments. One of the added challenges is addressing the Medicare physician payment formula. Regardless of whether it's permanently replaced or reformed as proposed by the Gang of Six, Congress will need to act to at least prevent the 29.4% payment cut from going into effect on January 2012. I think most, but certainly all Republicans, agree that they will not extend the physician fee fix or reform it without the proposal being fully offset. So there's certainly going to be added pressure with members continuing to struggle to look to find significant health care savings to offset either a one-year fix or a permanent repeal or reform of that formula.
What could go wrong, right?
Right, not out of the woods yet. So it will certainly be a fascinating year-end discussion with members looking to take an axe to a number of entitlement reforms. So I think at this point we're hopeful that they can do it in a meaningful way and will not just, you know, do it in a way that makes the numbers add up. So
interesting. Well, Heidi and Julie, thank you for joining us as always. Talk about the latest and greatest in healthcare regulation. For those who are interested in following these ladies and what they're talking about on a regular basis, encourage you to visit their website. That's capitalthinkinghealthcare.com, a great blog of what's going on in Washington, all you need to know about healthcare reform. It's a multi-year process, and you want to stay up on it. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about Campaign 2012 and more about the debt ceiling fight in Congress.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we spent some time talking about the rollout of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the latest information on health care reform regulations. It sounds like those are very busy sectors indeed of a Washington intent on regulating everything that moves and many of the things that are stationary as well. We're going to talk a little bit about the debt ceiling and also about campaign 2012, and we'll start out talking about the debt ceiling negotiations. And I think most polling data shows Americans hate both sides and feel like they both are acting like spoiled children who expect to get their way and will hold their breath until they get their way or they pass out. Most Americans, I think, are like me. They want to focus their thoughts in late July about the vacation they either just had or the beach trip they're about to take, and what are they going to read? Do they have the suntan oil? They don't want to hear that we might be going belly up in 2 weeks and that their retirement plans might lose a ton of money because they're invested heavily in bonds that will be blown up by the failure to extend the debt ceiling, and they're wondering why Washington is not being a little more serious about this. All kinds of irony and hypocrisy alerts flying here 24/7 right now. Latest as I'm sitting here this morning is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid basically clubbing the House Republicans for daring to go home this weekend. A little bit of an irony that Harry Reid's upset the Republicans are going home in the House for the weekend, that Democratic-controlled Senate is going to work through the weekend. And, of course, the Republican response is, we passed something earlier this week. The Republicans passed a bill called Cut, Cap, and Balance, which would require a balanced budget amendment and a cut in all spending in order to allow an addition to the debt ceiling. And meanwhile, a Democratic-controlled Senate hasn't introduced a budget. The House passed one earlier this spring. They voted down 97-0 the president's budget, and they haven't offered a viable alternative that they even want to bring up for debate on how to extend the debt ceiling. So Senator Reid's getting hit by the Republicans in return that the House would be happy to stay in session if, in fact, they had something from the Senate to act on, but they don't. The Senate is taking its own time, which is, of course, what the Senate does very well day in and day out. Republicans have a big schism of their own. Senate Republicans taking a very pragmatic approach, led by Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, trying to craft a deal that will allow an extension of the debt ceiling, basically flipping around the current process where the president would be able to go to Congress and notify them that he is going to raise the debt ceiling and propose some cuts, but that debt ceiling increase would be automatic unless Congress disapproves of that spending, and then the president could veto that disapproval, and Congress could vote to override it, but that would take a two-thirds majority to override it, and given the president's number of Democratic allies in both chambers, very unlikely to see a situation where they would, where he would veto the decision not to extend the debt ceiling, and Congress would somehow override his veto. So the McConnell bill would essentially be giving the president a great deal of latitude both now and in the future to raise the debt ceiling without a whole lot of congressional check on how that is going to occur. And it is very dissimilar from the current process that's being used right now. Meanwhile, House Republicans, if the Senate Republicans are pragmatic, the House Republicans are staying very much to the line they believe they promised voters in the 2010 election, that they're going to be serious about cutting spending, and they think this is the line in the sand that they have to draw. They voted on this cut, cap, and balance bill earlier this week, despite the fact that the media and the Senate said, hey, there's no way this is going to pass our chamber. President Obama has actually gone to the trouble of putting out what's called a statement of administration policy, which is essentially a veto threat. He will veto this bill if somehow it gets through the Senate. But Republicans in the House felt like we wanted to put a line in the sand and say, this is where we stand. We want these things to happen. And if the Senate votes it down, that provides a very clear contrast for them on Election Day, even though it doesn't get us any closer to a debt ceiling deal. I'm very pessimistic that we get anything done by the August 2nd deadline, except for a very short-term extension, maybe 6 months, 9 months, less than $1 trillion, maybe $1 trillion topped out, with a requirement that there be spending cuts that go with that. I think anything more than that, this thought of a grand bargain seems very unlikely in Washington right now. This is all impacting presidential politics and congressional politics. Again, the polling data shows that they hate everyone involved in the process right now. It's going to be another great election cycle to run against an incumbent and to blame Washington for everything. Republicans may be doing worse in the polling, maybe actually picking up more of the blame, even though they don't control the White House, than one would normally suspect. But there is a poll out today, headlined on the Drudge Report right now, if you click over there, that shows some data that shows the president tied with Mitt Romney, who's the Republican front runner for the nomination in 2012. And speculates that given the breakdown in the independent numbers, the president would probably lose the election if it was held today, and that he's at one of his worst polling points in his 3 years in office. I think that's going to be the president has to be very wary of that. You see him engaged in a very direct media campaign the last few weeks to get his side of the story out with the American public, and that's very interesting to see how many more press conferences we might have from him in the next week or two on all of this. Let me talk a little bit about the vice presidential nomination. We did a little of this in our podcast on Monday, but I'm actually very interested in who's going to be the Republican nominee for vice president in a couple of years, because that race, it, of course, doesn't have the same impact as the presidential nomination, but it could make a difference in what looks to be another close election. I think there are about 12 people who have a reasonable shot. I'm going to cover them almost in reverse order. You've got 8 or 9 former or current governors who I think are most likely to be considered, and you've got a couple members of Congress. The members of Congress, talking about Paul Ryan, who is the chairman of the Budget Committee and the guy who's backing the most stark difference between the Obama budget plan, and that's the Ryan budget that the House of Representatives passed earlier this year. Wisconsin's a battleground state. Ryan is young and vigorous and smart, somebody who does well in debates and loved by conservatives. Marco Rubio, the conservative darling who's in his freshman term from Florida, Hispanic, a chance to pick up Florida as an electoral state, make a play for the Hispanic population nationwide that's a growing segment of the voting population. But hard to see how the Republicans might pick somebody that inexperienced to go against Obama Biden, especially if you're saying Obama's inexperience is one of the reasons he hasn't done very well in the White House. Rob Portman, very well-regarded freshman senator from Ohio who served in the Bush administration, former House member. He's got strong ties to the Bush budget, which is both good and bad, but probably one of the most accomplished players in Washington who could be on a national ticket. The other congressman I think is considers Eric Cantor, the majority leader, somebody that has been turned into the whipping boy for President Obama, and somebody who could reach out to Jewish American voters. He is a Jewish American Republican and has a lot of cachet in that community. That segment had voted strongly for Obama, but is a little concerned with his Middle Eastern policy. I don't know if any of those guys will get it, but of those, I like Portman's chances the best. On the governor's front, the people that I like most, I don't have time to run through all of my governors here, but the people I think are three governors that have a potential shot. You've got Bob McDonnell in Virginia, Susan Martinez in New Mexico, first of female Hispanic governor in the United States and somebody fairly popular, and John Kasich in Ohio, who's helped turn that budget around, former congressman, has a lot of experience. But at the end of the day, I like Bob McDonnell of Virginia, not just because he's my governor and somebody I proudly voted for several times now, but because he's from a swing state. Virginia's in play. Obama barely won it last time around. He's got a conservative track record, went to Notre Dame, has a very good career as attorney general, done some great things in Virginia in his 3 years in office there as the governor, has a good story to tell. So I like McDonald today is the front runner to be the vice president. I don't think any of the current guys running for president, with the exception of Mitt Romney, have much of a chance to be considered for the vice presidential nomination. I think if they lose the nomination, they also lose the chance to be the VP. That's going to do it for Capital Thinking this week. I hope everybody finds somewhere to have some ice cream, stay cool in all of this heat over the weekend. We're going to be at the pool trying to stay out of the sun ourselves. We'll be back next Thursday with more updates on the debt ceiling negotiations and the fate of the free world. Until then, keep it here on the Voice America Business Network.
Joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.